Think it's a reasonable title. This is the outline. It's a sort of a generic outline. It starts with an introduction. Anyway, I'm going to introduce the subject a bit, then show you some things about discrete energy levels in normal grains to get us going. Then we'll get to the superconducting grains. This work here is basically a few years old. And so to make it up to date, I've added another part here on some very small grains, which we've been seeing spectra in the last week or so, which we don't really understand very well, but which I'm hoping some of the smart people here will come forward with explanations for that we can use. So to start out, I want to mention that in this line of work, there are various characteristic energies. The three which I'm going to be working with most here is the charging energy, the energy to add one electron onto a isolated grain. And notice there's a nomenclature problem. I call this EC for charging or Coulomb. You could use EC for Thouless for some reason I don't understand. And you call the level spacing delta, which has been used for the superconducting gap for years, so that everything has a different meaning than a lot of people here think. But anyway, let's go back to the subject. The charging energy scales with the radius, I mean the capacitance with the radius, the energy is 1 over r. The level spacing goes as the volume, or 1 over r cubed, so that if you compare those two, the level spacing relative to the charging energy, it is always smaller by a ratio something like this. This is just sort of schematic. And so in these experiments, the energy of adding the electron is the dominant energy, but the level spacing is quite large in some cases, particularly for small grains. The other energy that will play a role is the superconducting energy gap, by which I mean the gap in ordinary bulk material of the same sort. And way back in 59, Phil Anderson observed that probably superconductivity would be destroyed, that is to say, would not exist in a grain which was small enough so that the level spacing exceeded the energy gap. Now, that prediction sat around for a long time and is basically one of the things which what I'll be telling you about today confirms the basic correctness of that idea. So how do we do the experiments? I want to give you a long tour of the kitchen, only a picture of one of the pies that comes out. This is a technique that Dan Ralph developed. It's a scheme for studying this little grain of aluminum, which is very small, 30 angstrom sort of scale like that. And these are the two electrodes, so it's a two-terminal connection to this thing. And the connections are by tunnel junctions on these surfaces, just aluminum oxide. So we have an isolated grain into which we're going to add an electron and see what the energy cost is. This is a diagram I often use to remind us of the criteria for this thing to work. If you want to have a grain be called isolated, its tunneling resistance must be large compared to the quantum resistance, so that the number of electrons on the grain is a good quantum number. And it also has to be true that the charging energy is large compared to KT, so that the system knows exactly which number to have on it. So by those two criteria, one can make a sample which has a definite controllable number of electrons on it. Okay, now when you do this tunneling experiment, this is a kind of a diagram which often helps to clarify what's going on. Here are the two leads at different potentials by EV. Here's the particle or grain. This EC, and this is the Coulomb gap, which is large. These lines up here separate individual single particle energy levels whose spacing is small compared to the Coulomb gap, as I said earlier. So to get anything to go on here, you have to put on enough voltage so that this can tunnel into one of these levels here, and then it tunnels out again, or some electron tunnels out. So this is a so-called single electron tunneling, where one electron goes in, it must leave before another one can come in, because otherwise this energy goes sky high with more Coulomb energy. Another factor which is important for interpreting the data is this capacitance ratio, because the total voltage applied across here is what you measure, but the voltage between here and here is determined by the ratio of the capacitances of these two junctions. So that's something which you have to work out in some side experiment, and if you just don't know it, you can assume that they're roughly equal, in which case it's just a factor of two, but that need not be correct. Okay, now let's look at some of Dan Ralph's early data. This top curve shows the tunneling current through this structure that I showed you a picture of, and the Coulomb blockade extends from zero out here to something like 5 or 6 millivolts. That's the energy it takes to add an electron just because of the Coulomb energy. Then you have a series of steps here, and if you take the derivative, you get a series of peaks, and each of these is associated with a discrete state of some sort, and so as you increase the bias voltage, you can tunnel successfully into more than one state. So these are the first time, as far as we know, anyone saw discrete energy levels in a metal grain, so we're proud of that. And so we're going to be talking about these levels and how they interact with superconductivity and so forth. Okay, now when you see peaks like that, you usually wonder what determines their widths. And this is some of the early data showing something about that. Here the peak width, full width at half maximum is plotted versus temperature for a number of different peaks in one of those spectra. And what you see is that whereas the Fermi function derivative would give you this much width just from thermal smearing, the actual levels are a bit wider, but they do rise with temperature in this fashion, showing everything's basically understood in a qualitative way. Now, this is the peak width at the lowest temperature, where they sort of bottom out, versus the voltage, and you see that as you go up to higher voltages, you see broader peaks, and this is probably basically something that can be understood, although we don't have any quantitative fit or discussion to that. Okay, now let's look at the level spacing, where it gets a little bit more confusing. This is a bunch of data taken from that same epoch, and the dots represent the mean level spacing is determined by just looking at the levels you see and dividing by the number. And this line here is the theoretical prediction for the level spacing versus radius. It's supposed to go up as 1 over r cubed. And what you see is very little correlation between the data and the curve, right? Estimate the radius by measuring the capacitance of the grain and then inferring it from that. Yeah, the radius is poorly known. There's no doubt, but it's qualitatively correct. Now, at the time, we thought, gee, it doesn't fit too well. But then we realized that if we took clumps of peaks, we got a bigger interval. And thought, that maybe is the answer. But there's still, to me, a sort of an interesting tendency for these to all be down here, regardless of the size. So let's explore briefly what is now thought to be the explanation there. Then finally, we'll get to superconductivity. So this is a spectrum on another grain or two, and you can see why we talk about clusters. In this case, it looks like this might be one level, which for some reason shows up in a fragmented way. And so if you take spacings of these things, you get something that's more like the expected level spacing for the single electron states. Well, this was explained in a nice paper by Odette Agam and others, in which they pointed out that this is a bunch of energy levels like I showed you before with the potential across the junction, the different levels. These are the full ones. These are the ones you can tunnel into by adding the Coulomb energy. So if you have just enough voltage to reach the threshold, that means you can tunnel into this state only. Then the electron can either leave or another one can leave, and this one can drop down and reproduce the same setup. So all transitions are the same, and you get a single sharp peak. Well, if you looked at that last data, there was, in fact, always the first peak was single and sharp. So that's check one for the theory. So then the story gets a little bit more complicated. If you now raise the bias voltage enough to get up so you can tunnel into the second level that was empty, then you have more possibilities. Either it can leave, or some other one can leave, or things can drop down, or whatever. And this one up here is empty and hence can be tunneled into, whether the other hole is here, 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 or here. So you have a lot of different configurations, all of which have the same level empty to tunnel into, and because of the interaction between these different electronic states, the energy that you'll find here will be modified somewhat by which of these are occupied. That's the BISC qualitative model, which seemed to account for the clumping, and we were quite happy with that. And I bring it out here only because at the end, the new data I'm going to show you sort of opens up this question of multiple peaks. Now, I think that time is flying, so I better move to the superconductivity. So, if we went with the somewhat larger grains, we saw spectra like this for the derivative of the current with respect to voltage. No longer single isolated peaks, but a sort of a blank, then a sharp big peak, and then some humpy stuff along here. And as we increased the magnetic field, we saw that this first peak moved down to basically the Coulomb blockade. And so we interpret that as a superconducting energy gap, which was being run down to zero by the field. So let's look at some more data that are a little more informative, where you attempt to actually identify the discrete levels and see how they move with the magnetic field. And so we have two different graphs here. This one I've labeled even to odd, this one odd to even. That refers to the number of electrons on the grain. So we have a grain which has an even number of electrons, and I add one electron. I have to pay the BCS energy gap, and then as I crank up the field, the spin splitting reduces that gap to zero out here, and it's fairly straightforward. If I look at this one, where I had a grain which initially had an odd number of electrons, that meant one was unpaired, then I can tunnel in actually below the Coulomb blockade, because the electron I add can pair up with the one that was already sitting there unpaired, releasing energy delta. So you can tunnel in at a depth delta below the chemical potential, with the Coulomb blockade. So we get a very different spectrum for these two cases. So you can easily tell a grain which has an even from an odd number of electrons just by looking at that spectrum. Now then, this even-odd business, because of the necessity of an odd electron being unpaired, leads to the business that's called in general the even-odd effect in superconducting grains. And this is where the elementary theory comes in. If you just go to BCS and ask what is the binding energy relative to the normal state of a finite system, it is just given by this. This is the BCS gap, and this is the level spacing, which is a measure of the volume of the sample. But now if you have an odd number of electrons, one of them must be unpaired, so it must have an extra energy delta, the minimum gap energy. So you have this as being the energy, and what you can see from this is that as delta gets gets bigger, as the grain gets smaller, this term gets to be smaller than this one, and so the superconducting state is no longer lower in energy than the normal state, so there is no superconductivity. This is basically getting at the idea of Phil Anderson's argument, but he was not thinking about the even-odd so much as just even or odd, and so let's look at that. If you go to BCS and write down the so-called BCS gap equation, which is this thing up here, which tells you how to calculate delta, the gap, as a function of the occupation numbers and the one electron energies, in the continuum limits you get this standard result for the BCS gap in terms of coupling constant and so on. But in the mesoscopic regime you have to keep this as a discrete sum, and when you do that you get two different results depending on whether the number of electrons is even or odd. If it's even, you get this for the gap normalized to the bulk value versus the level spacing. So this is all at t equals zero. It looks like the gap going down at Tc, but this is really a plot versus level spacing or grain size, and it says that for an even number it should go should be normal above this case. For an odd number, this one here. by comparison, that simple model gave this factor as being a half, not 0.89. So this leads to the interesting idea that in this whole size range here, in principle, the thing should be superconducting if it has an even number of electrons, but add one electron, it should then be normal. Well, this is a cute idea, which, as far as I know, no one has been able to actually demonstrate, because it's damned hard to tell if a grain of this size is superconducting, except by looking at its gap, and the gap is sort of what you're looking at. So you could imagine a supersensitive squid looking for a Meissner effect, but it turns out the moment is less than one Bohr magneton for a typical grain, and it's sort of the same size as the Landau diamagnetism. I mean, it's just, it's not much of a superconductor. And so it gets to be hard to tell what you've got. Well, another thing we can look at is still to compare the data with these perhaps poorly measured but at least estimated radii with the data. And what's plotted here are for grains of different estimated radius, the gap as measured in the spectrum before you crunched it with a magnetic field. What you see is basically the gap is pretty much the same as the bulk value, and then it disappears. You don't see anything down here. And this overlay is sort of what those theory curves would say. That is to say, depending on whether you had an odd or an even number of electrons, in either case, the prediction is that for a size around here, you should stop being superconducting, and that pretty well agrees with the data, and these values are pretty much where the level spacing hits the gap. So that this, I think, is a good qualitative confirmation, at least, of the idea that small grains destroy superconductivity. Now, Ambegokar and Smith did some interesting calculations, of which this is just a result. They said that, after all, the levels are not uniformly spaced, as we assumed in making those simple estimates. You have to go to something like random matrix theory to give you a statistical distribution of level spacings. So then it depends primarily on the levels that are right at the Fermi energy, because the superconductivity, you know, stems from those electrons much more strongly than those further away. So in fact, it's the spacing of the two levels which span the Fermi energy which is most critical. And so given a standard mean spacing, you can have all sorts of different local spacings between levels. So what they came up with is the probability that there should be a superconducting gap, i.e. that it be superconducting in some sense, versus the mean level spacing. And the probability reaches 1 when the mean level spacing is very small, and it asymptotically goes to 0 out here, but it's a huge range here because the level spacings in a real sample are so far from uniform. So all theories based on uniform level spacings are basically useless. That's just to irritate theorists who sometimes calculate things like that because they're easy to do. They're great, actually. I wouldn't say they're useless. They're wonderful. They give us things to put on the screen and to sort of shoot at, and and in fact, they illustrate all the basic ideas fine. I mean, I'm just trying to get a rise out of you guys. This is such a dead audience. I mean, all you guys are here for this other stuff. I know I can't reach you. This is the 1 hour out of this week in which this kind of subject is not illegal. Anyway, so to try to press on finally to the late-breaking data, I have a postdoc now named Dragomir Davidovich, who said, Dan Ralph was very smart to invent that configuration, but he took all the equipment with him when he left to go to Cornell. Of course, he learned it all at Cornell and brought it with him, sort of, so that's fair enough. I mean, but so Drago said either he has to go ask Dan, you know, for permission to use his technique, or else he has to come up with something different. And he, of course, thought he could do something different and better. 2 years later, he's finally beginning to get some data, and it is different anyway. this is the kitchen shot, this is a blow-up of the kitchen. I think most people who are theorists don't really care how these experiments are done. So let's now look at some actual data. This was taken, I think, last week. And it's this is an IV curve on a single very small grain. He estimates the diameter is 2.5 nanometers. I'm a little doubtful of that, but it's small. And what we have here is the IV. Here is zero. There is data in here, but these were made in separate runs and blah, 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 so we just show it like this. So this is all the Coulomb blockade. This is no current, no current, no current, no current, no current. Here you start getting some current. Well, in the Dan Ralph data, that was just a smooth onset, and you took the derivative, you got that nice sort of semi-Gaussian or Lorentzian sort of peak. But this thing here shows a lot of structure, and all these other steps do too. So the interpretation that we are working on is that these things here are separate electron levels, all for the same electron number. That is to say, this is the Coulomb blockade, and these are just different states, and then the next step in the ladder would be someplace off scale here. So let's look at that data more closely, because that picture by itself isn't too impressive. Okay, that'll be all right. So here is, in the top panel, is just a blow-up of that first onset. Now, the current, unfortunately, increases downward in this picture. So here is the Coulomb blockade, just absolutely no current. And then it increases in a series of little bumpy things, bigger things, and so on. And it doesn't really look like a single level without any structure. And so this is now the derivative down there. And you can see, well, I will tell you, even if you can't see, that this level here is the noise level of the instrumentation. This is the Coulomb blockade. There's just nothing, and that's the precision with which nothing is measured. Incidentally, these currents, these are femtoamps, not nanoamps or picoamps, femtoamps. Of course, a lot of them. Now, I could have plotted attoamps and just had a bigger prefactor. So you see all of these peaks here, and a bigger peak and smaller peaks, and this might look suspiciously like noise or something, but that would cause an insult of a most profound sort to Dragomir, because he takes this data laboriously, carefully over days. Each point here is the average of three separate runs up and down, and then a new start, and so on. And they're averaged in hundreds of individual measurements for each point, and so on. So that all of these, this little structure, is actually reproducible from day to day. It's not that it is some kind of time-dependent noise. So this is something which, according to Odette Agam, should have been a single peak because there was only one option to tunnel into that topmost or the first available level. So this, I'm trying to get people interested in explaining just why that all occurs. I tried to count the number of peaks. The number of peaks is something like 15. That may have some relevance to something. I don't know. I mean, like multiplet structure and spin degeneracies and all the usual things you talk about. Now, if you raise the time? No, okay. If you raise the temperature and take the same kind of data up here at 3/4 degree, you can see it's already getting much more broadened and so forth. Up there at 6 degrees, it now just looks like a single bump. So this shows that if you want to see whether what you've got, you definitely have to get it very cold. Now, I've got another transparency of this which, in which the gains are adjusted so that you can see a little bit better. The vertical axes, in other words, are not the same anymore, but so here at the lowest temperature, one sees these sharply resolved things. Up here, they're beginning to run together, and up there they're completely run together. If you compare these widths with the expected widths from the thermal broadening in the Fermi functions in the banks, it's roughly correct, because we don't know exactly what that capacitance ratio is. It's hard to say, but the fact that these are smearing out like that is more or less what you would expect. Now, I personally find it somewhat interesting that you have these negative things here. That is to say that in the IV itself, the current does not monotonically increase as you increase the bias voltage. Now, that was never seen in the Dan Ralph things on the aluminum grains, and it's, again, a different feature of this data. Okay, time is running out, so I'll leap to my conclusions, which are rather prosaic. I think that Anderson's prediction that superconductivity is suppressed in small grains is correct. The fact that even electron numbers favor superconductivity, I think it's correct, but our experiments don't really exactly show that. But I think that there's very little doubt that it's true. And then this is the reference to the last kind of data, that these new experiments show a much more complex resonance spectrum than you'd ever expect from a particle in a box set of non-interacting energy levels. And I think that there's some interesting theory to sort out just what it is that we are seeing in those experiments. Thank you. You mean that place where there's the dot, dot, dots around zero? I'm not sure I'm understanding the question. Are you talking about this picture? And your question is, what's going on here? Oh, of course it's not symmetric. These are never symmetric. I mean, because the position of all these things is controlled by these infamous offset charges. And this is the trick that the people use, the so-called virtual or poor man's gate. If you apply a gate voltage, you can just shift the spectrum back and forth because it's basically changing the Fermi level in the grain. And so only in the case of great symmetry would you see the same thing in both directions. That's perfectly normal that it should be asymmetric. I admit, when I first saw it, I told the student, ridiculous. You think you're building a rectifier? Why is it different on the two sides? And then he explained it to me, so that's...
I mean, I understand that there is an offset, but I guess it's more surprising that the structure beyond the...
Well, it's not so bad, really, because depending on the sign of the voltage, you tunnel in a different way. I mean, you tunnel across a different junction. And so all the capacitances, ratios, and everything are different. Now, this is a sort of evasive sounding answer because I don't just have a zinger to give you, but it is quite normal. I'm sorry. It would be easier if it was symmetric. Yes, John.
All the structure on the right has to do with a single electron tunneling?
This is all single electron tunneling. I don't know what you mean.
Well, I mean, can you look at that curve and tell whether you're agreeing or not?
I can't. I asked Drago if he could tell me that, and he changed the subject. So I know this is pretty primitive at this stage, because without a gate, you don't have one of the tricks. I did set aside one transparency here showing the use of gates, if I can find it. It'll help. Oh, hell, this is beginning to be a disaster. No, I guess that I should give up. No, I'm getting close. This is some of Dan Ralph's data, and what's plotted here is the differential conductivity versus voltage, and all these curves are the same grain, and what's making the curves different is the gate the voltage is stepped up as you go along here. So you can take a feature which used to be over here, have it go through zero, come out on the other side, this thing comes out over there, and you can see the two sides are very different and so on. This is understandable, but it's not simple because of the different level structures and so on.
Can you tell us a bit about the experimental layout? The gold grain has an organic shell or something? Where is it?
Oh, the sample. I didn't give you enough time in the kitchen. This configuration, the two electrodes are made out of, in this case, chromium, and they have some oxide on them. And then one evaporates gold in a very thin layer, which makes a granular film. And one of those grains grows in the crack between these two things.
I'm sure you have only one grain there, or another parallel grain?
Well, we're pretty sure now, because when he first started doing this, he deposited more gold, and so sometimes he got complicated messes like you get if you got two. So he just kept cutting down the amount of gold until now the spacing statistically between these grains is very large, so it's unlikely just a priori that there would be two.
And
it,
oh no,
I mean these are no. I mean that the picture showing the setup, you'd have to imagine that there was some grain growing in there someplace, but the 2 nanometer thing is hard to see. I mean with when you're making the sample. Yes.
Can we translate the voltage scale in this new piece of data?
The voltage here is just the voltage applied between the two electrodes. So the amount of it appearing across each junction by this voltage division thing will be some fraction of that, which can only be determined if you can study a big enough sweep of IV to determine the capacitance from the Coulomb staircase. But here we're all looking at the first step of the staircase, so we don't have enough data. And if you increase the voltage much more, then you start getting things, you know, arcing, I mean, get breakdown of the sample. So there's a, you're limited as to how far you can sweep these voltages.
So you don't know what...
We don't know, no, we don't really know. We just assume that this spacing here gives some estimate of it, and that's as a Coulomb energy. Well, that's usually the case.
I said this is wrong.
Yep.